Testing. This is Betty Turnell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Mr. Lee D. Piggott, formerly principal of Decatur High School. And I might say that the D stands for Decatur, so today we are really talking to Mr. Decatur. Well, Mr. Piggott, we're very happy to have you here. And let's begin our story by asking you to tell us something about your childhood.
Well, I was born in Murfreesboro, Illinois, on July the 9th, 1893. My father was married three times. My mother's name was Ada Haltwick Caudle Piggott. And my father's name was Lee Decatur Piggott. There were 14 children in the family, and all of them lived but one to reach man and womanhood. I was the first from the first wife, was named Deason. The second wife was named Caudle, and the third wife was also named Caudle. My father's second wife and third wife were sisters. Dad, by trade, was a car repairman in the Mobile and Ohio shop in Murfreesboro, Illinois. I attended the grade school in Murfreesboro until the end of my sixth grade, when I quit work to go to school in the Mobile and Ohio shop. When I was 12 years old, I worked on the ice wagon, driving two small mules and delivering some very small pieces of ice, perhaps 12, 25 pounds, and the fellow who was the boss on the wagon delivering a larger one. One day, the boss on the wagon asked me to go in the saloon with him. Well, I was a little leery about doing that, but I went, and he ordered a stein of beer, and he asked me what I wanted, and I told him nothing, but he insisted that I take a small beer. Well, I said, I guess so. The bartender asked me if I had ever tasted beer, and I told him, not on your life. But I had a big brother who got drunk once in a while, and Dad forbid any of us to take a drink. He left, the bartender left, and returned with a small glass of beer. The bartender told me to drink all in one gulp if I could, and I tried, but it was real warm, and I had to take two or three gulps before I drank it all. I sat there on the stool for a while. My partner got the refrigerator filled with ice, and we went on our way. Before long, I belched, and I thought I was going to be sick. And later on, I was sick as I could be. I vomited all over the front of the wagon, and I said, no more beer for me. And after I felt better, I was sure that bartender had heated that beer to make me sick. I still thank him for what he did to keep me from wanting any more beer. While I was in the seventh grade at Logan School, a lesson taught me by my principal, Mr. Shoemaker, stayed with me for a long while. A group of us children who arrived early at school one morning after a light rain were playing in the schoolyard when the school principal arrived. There were small puddles of water on the walk, and the principal was jumping over them. And I saw him jumping, and I yelled, "Goody, goody, Mr. Shoemaker has to jump over the puddle." I thought no more about it until the seventh grade teacher told me to stay after school. She told me the principal wanted to see me. I went into his room, and he told me to sit on the front seat. I did. And I waited until all the pupils were dismissed. When they had gone, the principal came to me and said, "Lee, I'm going to teach you a lesson. You had better treat your elders with respect from this day on." Well, now, what had I done which was deserve such a lesson? He said, "You made fun of me this morning when I was jumping over the puddles of water." I tried to say more, but he said, "Be quiet," and pulled a rubber hose out of his pocket and hit me several times, blows across my leg. He could not make me cry because I was so taken by surprise, and I just wouldn't cry. I went home and told Dad I was ready to go to work and quit school. He asked me why, and I told him, and he said, okay. That was the end of my school education, grade school education. In later years, when I was in Murfreesboro, I tried to see Mr. Shoemaker, but I could not locate him. This was a turning point in my life. Dad secured me a job working in the bolt house in the Mobile and Ohio Railroad Yard. My job was to hand out bolts to the men working on the freight cars. I did not work long at this job, as I was transferred to the tool house in the machine shop, where I earned 10 cents an hour for a 10-hour day. I liked this job because the machinist, tool and die man, had his bench in the tool room, and he taught many little things that were a big help to me later. From the tool room, I was transferred to a very large drill press and a turning lathe, where I started on my apprenticeship as a machinist. I worked until I quit to go to school. My first paycheck at the shop was $18. I hadn't worked quite a month. I asked Dad how much he wanted for board and room, and he said, whatever you want to give. I said, well, $15 be enough from this check? Okay, he said. I kept the $3 and had most of it when my next check came due. There was nothing in town to spend it for except the ice cream parlor. And only a few boys ever went to the ice cream parlor. At about 18 years of age, I was taking a very active part in the young people's group at the Methodist Church. Dr. Cameron Harmon, the minister, took a very great interest in my future. He wanted me to go to McKendree College Academy and start on a high school diploma and an AB degree. He said he would get me a small loan per semester, which could be paid back after I graduated from college. He also said he would get me a job waiting on tables in the dining room for my meals, a job as janitor in one of the buildings, which would make it possible for me to get through. I told him I had not graduated from the 7th or 8th grade. What could be done about that? He said he would try to get me started on the first year of high school because of my age. And if I could carry the first year of high school, that would be okay. And I told him to talk to my father. Well, he talked to Dad, and Dad said, no, he's learning a machinist trade. It'd be foolish for him to leave and go now, and I will not let him go. Well, the same thing came up the next year, with Dad saying, absolutely not. By this time, I really wanted to go, and I told Dad I planned to go, that I had asked for a railroad pass to go to St. Louis. He said, Lee, if you do go, don't ever step a foot into this house again.
Mr. Piggott, how old were you at this time?
I was about 19 years old.
And McKendree College is in St. Louis?
It's in Lebanon.
Near St. Louis.
Well, I made the plans to go. Dr. Harms made the plans for me to enter McKendree College Academy. Several of my sisters and brothers intended to go with me to the 4 a.m. train. And Dad learned about it and said, no, let him go alone.
That was a really difficult experience, wasn't it? Right.
Well, I arrived at McKendree September 1916. Was assigned a room with Dr. Cameron Harmon's grandson, John Harmon Jr. Did janitor work, rang the rising bell in the dorm, was head waiter in the dining room, and took a very active part in athletics. My athletics awards that I won there was 4 awards in baseball, 4 in basketball, 2 in football, 1 in tennis, and 1 in track. Many interesting things happened while I was at McKendree. I was mentioned only 3 or 4 of them. A minister by the name of Brown, who was a student at McKendree, sold a freshman a textbook which had many leaves torn out of it. The freshman tried to get Brown to take back the and repay him for the money for the book because it was no good, but Brown refused. The freshman threatened to go to the president. Brown wagered him to go, that he had the scripture to prove that he was right. The freshman went. The freshman went to the president, who was a minister also. The president called Brown in and gave him the devil. The president told Brown he could give him the devil, but he could justify his actions by the Bible and by the scripture. And the president said, if you could do that, I'll forget it. Brown said, I'll quote the scriptures and you see if this isn't correct. And he quoted the scripture, he was a stranger and I took him in. Brown returned the money to the fellow student. Lebanon was a small town with little way of entertainment for college students, with few places to take your date. But there was a small cemetery a block or two off the campus where there were benches to rest our weary young bone. I was there by myself on Sunday one afternoon looking over the quotations on the tombstone when I came upon an odd inscription which read, she was more to me than I expected. I have often wondered what life had been between the man and that wife. The third thing was this. College, which had been founded in 1818, the first college in Illinois, also was the oldest, had the oldest chapel bell in the United States. Two authoritative documents and articles in different magazines. This historic bell in the tower of the chapel at the tiny McKendree College of Lebanon, Illinois, the tones of which McKendree Chapel bell were heard long before the foundation of the famed Liberty Bell, long before Columbus discovered America. The above is a copy from, this was a copy from the Macon News. I found that afterward. Mm-hmm. From the Macon News, Thursday, the 3rd, 1955, the year 1918. I climbed up in the steeple of the chapel building and examined the bell and the clock and how the chimes were played. I shall never forget that experience. My experience in athletics proved very valuable to me in my future in college career. I remembered that we defeated the Carlisle Indians football team, which was one of the highlights of my career in football. I really had a great time at McKendree, and I enjoyed my job as head waiter in the dining room, my work as janitor in the science building, and ringing the rising bell in the boys' dormitory and the girls' dormitory. There were many, many other things I had pleasure in doing, but my schoolwork came hard for me. My grades were very low in Greek, Latin, English and history, but I did pass mostly because the professors thought I tried. All this time I played football, basketball, and track. It may have been my coach who talked them into giving me passing grades to keep me from on the team. At the end of my first year at McKendree, I wrote to my father and asked if I could come home for the summer and get a job in the shop and save some money for the school. My stepmother wrote back and said, Dad said no. Mm-hmm. I was not welcome. Now, that really was a blow. So I had to find something to do that summer to help pay for the next year's school expense. My roommate, Pfeiffer, and I talked it over, and we decided to go to Kansas and follow the wheat harvest, cruise through Kansas and Oklahoma. As soon as school was out, we stored our school things and went to St. Louis, caught a freight train, which is headed west. We had no trouble riding on top of the freight cars because the West needed men for the harvest, and the railroad did not object to taking men out there. We got to Anthony County, Kansas, a short time before the threshing crew arrived in the county. But we found work on the Gaither farm shocking wheat. We were both green hands, but we learned quickly, and the work was hard and the hours were long. But we had a job with board and room. We bathed in the watering trough where the cows and the horses drank. The animals soon got used to us and didn't matter much to them. On my birthday on July the 9th, the family had a birthday cake for me. I had not shaved since I left college in June, so I celebrated and shaved before I went down to supper. The family was surprised. In fact, they did not recognize me at first when I first came into the room. Within about 10 days at Gaither's, we got a job in a thrashing rig and went with them until they finished in the neighborhood. When the job ran out, my friend from school who was with me went home. I gave him my watch, practically all my money, to keep for me and for him to bring it back to school in September. One of the men told me that a farmer, Mr. Jones, needed a farmhand to haul wheat to the elevator and that he would take me there on his way home. He let me off at the lane that led to the house and drove on. Well, I was all alone, out far from anywhere. I went to the house, knocked at the door. A woman about 60 years old, dressed in a dirty house dress, opened the door and asked, "What you want? What do you want?" I told her I understood that Mr. Jones needed a hired hand to haul wheat to the elevator in Oklahoma. "Yes, he does, but he's not at home. May I stay until he comes?" "Yes, come in." "No," I said, "I'll go out to the barn." So I went out there where I won't bother you with your work. I did, and Mr. Jones arrived a short time later and gave me the job. We stayed outdoors until we were called to supper. There were 7 girls and 1 boy in the family and myself at dinner that night, besides Mr. and Mrs. Jones. I don't recall who asked the blessing, but someone did. When we started eating, the mother realized that there was no bread on the table. She asked the oldest daughter to get some bread. She got up from the table, got a loaf of bread, broke it off into pieces, and threw it to her mother, father, brothers, and so forth. When she threw it my way, I was ready and caught mine. After dinner, Mr. Jones said he would take me up to my room for me to get my suitcase. He lighted a lantern that had a broken globe, which had been patched with starch and paper or some such stuff. The light came out in only one place, and not much light at that. He took me upstairs to my room, but I could not see much of the room because of the poor light from the lantern. He put the lantern down on something, and something like bees began filled the room. He apologized about the condition of the room and said that his wife would clean it up the next morning. Then he left, saying no more. Well, the only thing I could do was to go to bed and sleep until morning. I put on my pajamas, and as was my custom, I knelt down beside the bed to say my prayers. I was about finished my prayers when I felt something crawling on my foot. Mm-hmm. I tried to ignore it, but I couldn't. So I said, "Amen." Got the lantern and turned it as best I could, most of the light from it, and saw what I thought looked like a louse. Mm-hmm. Well, what to do? I thought, well, a while and decided I would take off the cover, the sheets and the pillowcases off the bed and shake them and sleep without cover. I did shake them and I had no more trouble with lice, but I could not sleep because it was so cold. When he called me for breakfast, I said I was not hungry because I was late for the thrashing. The wife said she would clean the room and get the sugar sack out of the room so the flies would not bother. When I drove to the farm where the thrashing machine was, the farmer told me my turn would not come up for a while, that his wife wanted to see me before I took the first load. I drove up to the house, tied the team to the rack, and walked in. I was greeted with a, have you had any breakfast? No, I'm not hungry. She said, sit down at the table while I fry some bacon and eggs and make some toast and see if I can find a cold glass of milk. I sat down. She did find the other thing. In addition, she said, you are to return home here for your dinner. No matter how late you get back in the evening, you are to come here for your supper, and you are to return here for your breakfast each morning. I asked her why she and her husband were taking such interest in me. She said they knew I was working in the harvest to get money to go to college, that she and her husband wanted to be sure I stayed until harvest was over. I did stay, and I did enjoy the rest of the threshing season. After the threshing was finished in that area, I stayed with the Joneses until I left for Illinois. The Joneses' home was cleaned up, the family had prayer at meals, and I really was glad that I stayed. One day, which I turned out to be my last day with the Joneses in Oklahoma, the family went to the city. I was to stay behind and open up a field by plowing it in the spring. I was told to go to the pasture, which was 160 acres, on a certain pony and let the pony pick out four ponies to bring in to the barn lot. But I asked, how am I to know which ponies to pick out? Mr. Jones told me to pick out a certain pony whose markings I knew, and then let my pony pick out the rest. Well, my pony did a good job picking out the other three. And I harnessed the four ponies to the plow, which had no tongue. I had the devil of a time doing it, but I did. The field I started in to plow was 1/2 mile long. I had asked Mr. Jones how to start the first row in order to get it straight. I followed his direction and looked down the field for an object to aim for. His instructions were to find an object, start the team, get the plow on the ground, keep my eye on the object selected, look straight ahead, and keep the team headed straight for the object, and I would have a straight row. Well, I did as instructed. When I got to the object I aimed for, I was on target. Then I turned around and looked at the crookedest furrow I had ever seen. I was disgusted with myself. But by the end of the day, I had a rather straight furrow. It was about quitting time when the Jones family came back from town. When I finished one furrow close to the road, the oldest Jones girl waved the letter towards me and placed it on top of the mailbox and put a cloud of dirt on it. I decided to plow one more round and then go back to the house. I plowed the round and drove the team and the ponies back to the barn. I had had a devil of a time with the horses all day, but as they got tired, they were less trouble. By the time I got them back to the barn, they were acting okay. Mr. Jones and his son came out to help me unharness the ponies. The boy looked at the four ponies and slapped himself on his leg and starting laughing. He punched his father in the ribs and pointed to the ponies. Mr. Jones also started laughing. And I got a little disgusted in the way they were acting until Jones said, three of those ponies had not been broken to harness. Well, then I understood while I had much trouble with them all day. I had read the letter that the girl left on the mailbox for me, and good news was in it. Lee, come home as soon as you get here. I told them they had a joke on me with the ponies, but that I had some good news for myself. I wanted one of them to drive me to town the next morning so I could catch a train home. I was greeted with open arms at home by Dad and the rest of the family. I went to work immediately in the tool room of the machine shop at 10 cents per hour. Dad wanted me to stay at home when it was time for me to return to McKinley College in Lebanon, Illinois. But I knew I would go back. I returned to McKinley College in Lebanon in September for another year. We had a new basketball coach when I returned, a Mr. Cy Gentry, who was a Rhodes Scholar and who had just finished his work in England. He had a great influence on the boys in the school. He was young and youthful and good-looking, clean in every respect. When he took charge of the basketball practice, you felt you would get a fair break. I weighed 130 pounds, was 5'10" tall, and felt I had a good chance to make the team as anybody else. And I did make it, and if I did not make it, it would be my fault. We had three fellows who were over 6 feet tall, and one was 6 feet six. I did make the team, and the three big fellows on our team protected me all they could. I was fairly good shot when close to the basket. One game I made several short shots in a close game, and the opponents roughed me up too much for the big boys to take. And one of the big players picked one of their rough ones up by the leg and an arm and butted his head against the wall, and that put an end to their rough tactics. At the middle of the fourth year at McKinley, Dr. Kendra Harmon was elected president of Missouri Wesleyan College at Cameron, Missouri. He asked his brother John, Merrill Pollard, and myself to go with him to Missouri Wesleyan, and he would see that we were taken care of financially. We went there the next semester and were given jobs which took care of our expenses. I was asked to preach on Sundays at Catawba and Proctorville and Ludlow and another place in the circuit. I did this all the time I was in Cameron and in Missouri Wesleyan. In 1918, I wanted to join the Naval Aviation. I talked to my chemistry teacher and my psychology teacher, and they both said they would see that I got passing grades for the semester if I left to enlist. I borrowed a motorcycle and drove to St. Louis, St. Joseph, Missouri to enlist, but they were not taking any enlistments in the Air Force, but they were to take in some next week at Kansas City. The next week, I borrowed the motorcycle again to go to Kansas City. The roads were dirt roads, and they were dusty. I was not used to riding a motorcycle. I was thinking about enlisting in the Air Force, more about that than I was thinking about road condition. I turned a right-angle corner and found myself in the dust in the road, and the motorcycle laying on the side out in the road. I was not hurt. I got up and got on the cycle, and away we went. I stopped at a farmhouse when I got close to Kansas City and asked directions of how to get to the address they gave, I gave them. They wrote down the direction and gave them to me. Just as I was leaving, they told me, watch out for the dead policeman when I went through the park. I said, okay, thanked them and went on my way. When I got on the motorcycle, I asked myself, well, why should I be afraid of a dead policeman? The heck with them. I got to Kansas City Park and entered and found a nice paved road on which I could make good time. I turned the throttle up and everything went fine until I hit a bump in the road. I thought, that's funny, a bump in such a good road as this. And I was just about a short distance until I hit another one. Said, I must be careful from now on. The mounds on the concrete were across the road all through the park. I vowed to myself I would find out what those bumps were put there for. When I got to the recruiting station, I registered and asked the lieutenant what those strips across the road were for, and what were they called? And he told me they were dead policemen, and that they're placed there to control the speed of the traffic. Well, I passed the examination for the aviation mechanic and was told to await orders at my present address. I was called to Great Lakes Naval Academy. I wrote my parents and told them, and I had enlisted in the Naval Aviation, and they seemed to be pleased. John, my older brother, had been drafted and was in the Army in France. Well, I waited anxiously for my call to come. When it came, I said goodbye to the fellows in the summer school, headed by way of train to Great Lakes to be introduced to a new type of living. I was signed to the barracks. The training of the program went very well. I remember when we were in schedule to take the examination, given by a hard leather-necked sailor, that my teacher told me he expected me to head the class in the test. Well, I did take the test and failed it. Mm-hmm. Boy, did that teacher tell me what a dirty trick to play on the company. The Navy officer scared me so badly that I hardly knew what I was doing. Mm-hmm. The teacher said he would get me for letting me down, and I think later that he might have done it. I'll tell you about that soon. Well, things went along well in our training. Our group and others in the camp were sent to Winnetka to build an outdoor seating arrangement for an outdoor theater. We liked the job because it sent us out a lot of, because it led us a lot of, because it gave us a lot of freedom. I do not recall how long it took us to do the job, but about the time we finished the outdoor theater job, the influenza epidemic of 1918 hit Great Lakes. The camp as a group did not take the flu seriously, as the number of cases grew and the sick bay would not take care of them. One large sleeping quarter building was filled with cots for the sick. As I remember, two of the buildings were occupied by the sick. The doctors were short of help. To keep the place clean, men were chosen to do the janitor work and to carry out the dead who seemed to be immune to the flu. I was one chosen for the work. I wondered if my officer chose me because I had let him down on the not time test. Mm-hmm. I thought it over for a while and decided no one would do a dirty trick like that. Mm-hmm. After that, the flu was so bad that those who could not withstand the germ had to do the work. I hope we never have to go through anything like that again. But we do not know what life has for us in the future. After the flu was over, we went back to work on planes. We were not interested in the work anymore because of the armistice was signed on November the 11th, 1918. We were interested in going home. The day before Christmas, our company was sent out on the working party for the day. That night, Harry Wills, a neighbor boy from our hometown, visited me, urged me to come to the big parade to be held in the main camp the next day. Well, I told him we had been assigned a working party. To make the story short, I told him I would cut working party and visit him, which I did the next day. When I returned to the barracks that evening after the parade, there was no one there. I waited there an hour so when hour or so when an officer came in. I asked, "Where's my company?" He said, "Get your sea bag and follow me," which I did. Finally, I found out that my company was discharged on Christmas Day, 1918. I was assigned duty to haul snow in a wheelbarrow in the camp, from the camp to a ravine on Christmas Day in 1918, and until January the 1st, 1919, when I was discharged early in the morning. I caught a passenger train at 11 a.m. At Decatur and arrived in Decatur at 3:20 p.m. January the 1st, 1919. My girlfriend, Jessie Crowder, met me at the train. I had known her while I was in college when I was in school there. She invited me home to have dinner, and her folks invited me to stay with them until I found a job. I thanked them and accepted their invitation because I knew no one else in Decatur. The next morning, I heard of a position with the Decatur Railroad YMCA. I visited the YMCA office, applied for the job, gave them my experience I'd had with the YMCA in Cameron, Missouri, and he said for me to come back the next day, and in the meantime, he would telephone Cameron, Missouri for my recommendations from Cameron, Missouri YMCA. I applied for the job at the Pines Community Center, which was run by the Railroad YMCA. The next day when I returned, he told me he would recommend me to the YMCA board as soon as I could get them to meet, as soon as he could get them to meet. I returned every day for a week or so, and each time he told me the job was mine, but I could not start until the board approved it. I told him I was running out of money and would try for another job in the city. Tried the Wabash shop, East Lady Manufacturing Company, and others with no luck. One afternoon, I walked to the Millikan University gym to watch the practice basketball. I sat on the bleachers and watched them for a while. One fellow practicing walked over and yelled up to me and said, "Aren't you one of the McKendree College players who played here the little 19 basketball tournament?" And I nodded, "I was." He came and talked basketball for a while, and he asked what I was going to do. I told him I was looking for a job. He said, "Why don't you come to school here and play basketball?" I told him I did not have any money. He said, That's easy. I can call the coach and you talk to him about an athletic scholarship." He sent the coach up. We talked a while and looked at the He looked me straight, real straight in the eye and said, "Let's go see the president about an athletic scholarship." We talked to Dr. Taylor, and I started school second semester, 1918-1919. I started school in third college since I left home, and I was able to stay in school through the kindness and understanding of the college teachers and administration. I had some trouble transferring my credits from McKendree and Missouri Wesley through James Milliken University, but Milliken straightened it all out for me, so I entered in good standing. My first big job at Milliken was through tile a quarter mile cinder track so the water would run out of the tile on Oakland Street. I remember that the price per foot was very good. Besides, I became acquainted with Mr. Carl Head and Professor L.M. Cole. Both of the men were valuable boosters for me, and a friend indeed. I recall going through the school machine shop one day when some of the boys were having trouble in the machine shop, were trying to bolt a complicated piece of machinery on the bed of the planer, and they could not get it job done. I worked with them, we got it set in place. When I said, well, check it over and I'll go on to the wood shop, well, Mr. Cole was standing back of me and he said, good job, Lee. Where did you learn to do that? I told him my work in the machine shop at home. All he said was, good, let's go to the wood shop. And that's the end of the rest.